Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky, and you are listening to the audio cast of my blog, Sentient Developments, Transhumanist Perspectives on Science, Philosophy, Ethics, and the Future of Intelligent Life. Topics discussed on Sentient Developments Radio include transhumanism,
bioethics,
human enhancement,
the singularity,
accelerating change,
technology,
neuroscience,
cosmology,
catastrophic risk,
existentialism,
spirituality,
philosophy,
science. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky, broadcasting to you today on Monday, December the 11th. That's right, broadcasting once again. I haven't podcasted since last May. I'd like to make this a regular thing once again, maybe around once a week. Hopefully I can streamline the process and be able to do it rather quickly. That will be the key for me in terms of being able to do this on a regular basis, and hopefully it won't keep me away from the writing, because if there is no writing, there's nothing to talk about for the podcast. I apologize if the audio quality is not 100%. I am using a $5.99 computer microphone from Radio Shack. My normal microphone that I normally use, a studio mic, is on loan. My friend Simon Smith has my microphone, so maybe I should go pay Simon a visit, reclaim my microphone. Also, my effects processor blew up the other day, so I can't even run it through a nice processor anymore. Anyways, we'll make do with what we've got. I'm hoping that I'm coming in loud and clear, and we'll make do with this $5.99 microphone. Just to briefly talk about today's episode, I'd like to talk, just give you some news first of all. I'm going to talk about Darren Aronofsky's The Fountain. I'm going to give that a bit of a review. I'm going to talk about the recent chess match between Kramnik and Deep Fritz. And time permitting, I'm going to talk about some bizarre time jumping involved in the brain and in the brain's cognition. Does the brain tap into the future? So Just before we get started, though, with those items, just wanted to pass on some news. I was approached recently by the CBC. It's the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. I guess for those of you in Europe, you might know the British Broadcasting Corporation, or even in just to give you an idea of what we're talking about. It is pretty much Canada's premier, a news source when it comes to the visual medium and radio. I guess in terms of the best papers here in Canada, that would probably fall to the Globe and Mail. But in terms of television and radio, CBC is definitely one of the more premier news sources here. So it's a pretty big deal for me to be approached by them, particularly because it's for the show called The Hour, which they're going to be doing in the new year, a three-part special on the future. And they're going to be interviewing me. I'm going to be going in there in about 2 weeks' time. They're going to interview me for about an hour. We're going to talk about what's interesting, I actually want to talk about some of the more radical potentials for humans and post-humanity, which definitely sounds will be very exciting for me. And they're going to film me in front of a green screen, which would be very cool, because they're going to be putting some very neat backdrops behind me for when it becomes when production is complete during the post-production. So very exciting, and I'm very much looking forward to doing this, and hopefully I won't embarrass myself there in front of a camera. So I will keep you up to date on that, and of course we'll blog about the whole experience and see how that goes. Thank you. I love science fiction, particularly science fiction movies. So it was safe to say I was pretty excited by the fact that Darren Aronofsky was putting together a movie called The Fountain, not just science fiction, but dealing with those issues that are run deep and dear to me, namely life extension and immortality. Now, I was also excited because Darren Aronofsky directed a movie I'm very fond of back in 1998 called Pi. And Pi is a movie in which the lead character is a mathematical genius, and he's driven to obsession by his conviction that he can find or unravel the mysteries of the universe through numbers and patterns. It's really well done, and I do recommend it, but unfortunately I can't say the same in regards to The Fountain. I was really, really expecting to love this movie. I kind of heard going into it that I might be disappointed that his message wasn't perhaps going to be life extension friendly or transhumanist friendly, and that was very much fulfilled. I think he really squandered an opportunity to do something quite interesting and quite unique, and instead, he created what was really visually stunning, but the movie just ended up perpetuating long-standing myths and misconceptions about death and the quest for extended life. Now, just a warning for those of you that have not seen the movie and you're sensitive to spoilers, you might want to just fast forward this about 10 minutes or so, because I'm going to talk about some spoilers here. Now, to unravel the morality behind immortality, Aronofsky, he basically directed the movie, or wrote the movie, with three different settings. He had Spanish Inquisition era, Spain, and the New World. He also had characters take place in the present, and he also had parts done in the future. And all of these were kind of interspersed in a multi-narrative that all kind of intertwined together. Now, what was interesting was the Inquisition era Spain and South America. He used that, I think, to represent kind of the historical quest for immortality, very much like Ponce de Leon looking for the Fountain of Youth in Florida. But it was more like Indiana Jones as Ponce de Leon amongst the Mayan Indians. He also used this this setting to offered an analogy for the main characters, kind of a different take on the relationship. And actually, this was one of the more interesting parts of the story, because you've got this Spanish queen. She sends a conquistador to the New World on a quest to find this mythic tree of life. It's the sap that will offer eternal youth, kind of like the Fountain of Youth type thing. The queen, though, her life's very much in danger because the Inquisition is drawing near. They're ready to get her because of this rather unholy desire for extended life. Now, this is a side story. I thought it actually beautifully mirrored the current religious inhibitions and even popular inhibitions against life extension. Maybe it was an unconscious thing on Aronofsky's part, but I certainly noticed that. But needless to say, it was not fully developed, and it was never really fully exploited, but I guess that should be expected, considering that the real purpose of The Fountain was to kind of give a value to death, and I guess it only makes sense to underplay that. The second setting was modern day. You've got this doctor, Thomas Creo. He's a medical researcher. That's played by Hugh Jackman, and he's on an obsessive quest to cure his ailing wife of terminal cancer. So here we have another Aronofsky film where the main character is driven by obsession. But in The Fountain, the main character's flaw is his inability to kind of come to grips with death and its greater purpose. His wife, Izzy, is dying, played by Rachel Weisz, and she, on the other hand, has completely come to grips with the fact that she will soon die, and she's reached this inner peace. She's very much at peace with herself and her world and her pending death. But her husband, he's completely blind to this. He doesn't acknowledge where she's at all, and instead he's constantly in the lab looking for that miracle breakthrough, and he doesn't spends very little time with Izzy. During her last days, he is away from her, working feverishly to find a cure. Now, I have to say, this was kind of insulting, this whole portrayal of a patient dying of a brain tumor. It was quite dishonest. Izzy would have the odd fainting spell and maybe a lack of sensation, but she most certainly did not look like somebody who was dying of a terminal illness. And in a movie that explores the merits or the value of death, to kind of be this kind of dishonest about it, I thought was beyond the pale. She was young, she was intellectually and emotionally vibrant, just days away from her death. This is, in my mind, a very irresponsible idealization of the dying process. And of course, by showing a young person dying, we get to ignore you know, the what aging does to the body. We're not going to show old people dying. Let's show a young, beautiful person dying, because you know, aging, because dying is beautiful, right? Well, Izzy, despite, I mean, she's got a great attitude about death, and it's certainly laudable. But I have to say, it's probably in a, she's probably very much in the minority. It's hardly representative of all terminally ill 30-somethings. There is very much often, I think, a fine line that separates inner peace from utter resignation. Now, predictably, of course, Tommy does not save his wife in time. He's devastated by her death, and he resolves to take his research to the next level. At her funeral, he kind of moves away from the crowd. He admonishes the defeatism of the mourners, and he declares that aging is a disease that must be cured. That's familiar rhetoric to all of us life extensionists. That was a pretty damning characterization of the life extensionist, this idea that anti-aging, it falls outside the natural scheme of things, and that this desire to avoid death leads to an obsessive life and an unfulfilled life. You know, he's obsessive, he didn't spend enough time with his wife, he was in other words, he was detached from life, he wasn't enjoying it or understanding what life is all about. And needless to say, this is where the fountain does fall quite flat. Now, personally, as a Buddhist, I think about death all the time. I meditate on it. I think about the inevitableness of my own death. And I like to think I've got a fairly healthy and, you know, by Western standards, a non-traditional attitude about my death, my mortality. I harbor no false illusions about the impermanence of my life. Now, future breakthroughs in life extension notwithstanding, I fully expect to die at some point. But that does not mean I have to like it. Nor does it mean I have to rationalize death in such a way that I've got to, you know, put a positive spin on it. In The Fountain, Aronofsky dips into Mayan mythology, and he suggests that there can be no life without death, that it is really only through death that life can emerge. And in this sense, Aronofsky is portraying death as a creative force rather than a destructive one. Now, personally, I find very few redeeming qualities in aging and involuntary death. Death is destructive. It brings about suffering, both for those who are dying and for those who are around their loved ones who are dying. Death destroys memories, wisdom, brilliance. It destroys those unique personalities that are around us. But more to the point, death is not a requisite for birth and life. That's a rather strange correlation that Aronofsky has put forth here. Which leads to the final setting that's explored by Aronofsky in The Fountain, and that's a fantasy sequence that's set off in the distant future, I think like the year 2500. Thomas would appear, or some kind of incarnation of Thomas, has come to possess this tree of life, and he finds himself afloat in space in what looks like a giant snow globe. It's actually visually stunning, just gorgeous. Actually, even the sequences where he's kind of like doing this Buddhist meditation thing, which was actually really, from my own perspective, very cool to see, very transcendent, very spiritual. But it had, other than the visual, I guess, linkage with Buddhism and Eastern philosophies, there was no practical linkage between that and what Aronofsky was putting forth. Because there even wasn't a kind of a, maybe I suppose from the sense of reincarnation, but I don't know. It wasn't really that explicit. But anyways, so there's Tommy. He's in a snow globe. He's going toward a dying nebula, and the tree is dying. And he's trying to reach this nebula as perhaps some last gesture of rebirth and some dedication to his long-dead wife. Kind of a neat thing that Aronofsky does here, kind of to show the passage of time, and again, to kind of the linkage with the tree of life. Tommy has etched these tattoos on his arm that very much resemble the kind of patterns you'd get, the rings of a tree when it's been cut. That was actually kind of cool. But anyways, Tommy has an existential epiphany. He finally comes to grips with his own mortality, and his seed-like space globe enters the birth canal-like nebula in what is, I suppose, what's meant to be this representation of fertilization and renewal. In death, there is new life. And then, in the final shot of the movie, we return to modern day. Tommy visits Izzy's grave, and he's all, you know, content, and he's come to grips. Obviously, he's come to grips with the death of his wife. Oh, man, talk about sentimental claptrap. I was expecting, I have to admit, something considerably deeper and intellectual from Aronofsky. Instead, this movie was way overhyped, sugar-coated. There wasn't any humor in it at all. I mean, it was so dour. I mean, it was all done in these wonderful golden hues, but It certainly had no levity at all. And, he perpetuated, I think, these idealized entire notions of death and what it means to humanity. And I suddenly have the urge to pull out some classics from, like, 2001 and Blade Runner from my DVD shelf to kind of explore some of the more profound images and ideas for where humanity might go in the future. Some of the existential, you know, and difficult and gray and hazy issues. You know, not this kind of facile, you know, petty moralizing, this kind of real easy moralizing. Oh, anyways, you'd be best to avoid it and just stick to some of the classics. And if I do ever, of course, see a great science fiction movie, I'll certainly pass it on, but not this year. So, Vladimir Kramnik got crushed by Deep Fritz at the RAG tournament in Bonn, Germany. Well, I shouldn't say crushed. In all fairness to Kramnik, he actually put up an excellent fight against the machine. And I think he probably did better than any Grandmaster would have done against Fritz. But when all was said and done, he had lost two matches against Fritz, one due to a blunder. But hey, that's all part of the game. It's all part of the human condition. You know, humans, we get tired, we get stressed, overconfident, and that's part of being a biological entity that computes, trying to, you know, play an expert machine, a chess bot. And you know, credit where credit is due. The Fritz team put together an excellent program, and yeah, I mean, I'm wondering now, what is the future of chess? Where are we at now? I mean, the whole Deep Blue and Kasparov thing is definitely way behind us. Now we've got these man-machine tournaments where humans cannot beat the chess bots. We're tying them more often than not. In fact, Kremnik admitted that every game he goes into against Fritz, he was assuming a draw and never thought that he could win. And this is where we find ourselves at the end of 2006. The best chess-playing humans are unable to beat the expert chess bots. And I wonder if the day is coming soon where even this will become impossible, where we lose every game, or that the Grandmasters will lose every game. But, you know, a part of me thinks that chess is a little too complex for today's computers to achieve, you know, constant victories. I think computer power and programming is going to have to be a lot more powerful by an order of magnitude before they can start to, you know, generate these algorithms that's going to result in what's called perfect play, resulting in these perpetual streams of victories. And this is also assuming, though, that chess can be solved in a strong sense, and I'm not convinced this is possible. In the vast space of all possible games, perfect play in chess will lead to draws more often than not. That's all. I guess that's fair. The most solved the chess could ever become, I think, is in the weak sense where an algorithm can secure a win for one player or a draw for either against any possible moves by the opponent from the initial position only. It ultimately comes down to complexity. And how complex is chess? Well, before I talk about chess, let's talk about some simpler games like tic-tac-toe and checkers. Now, tic-tac-toe, much to my surprise, has 765 different positions. Who knew? Or 26,830 possible games, and it's just on a 3x3 grid. And that's quite a lot. But that's hardly intractable. And as a result, it's actually quite easy to write a computer program that can deal with all the possible variations, and the computer can play a perfect game. In fact, it's so simple that not only can computers play a perfect game, but humans can consistently play tic-tac-toe with perfect play, which is why you and your human opponent are pretty much can always be guaranteed that the games will end in a draw. Now, checkers is a lot more complicated. It's on an 8x8 grid, and it has 10 to the power 12 possible positions. Some people think it has 5 by 10 to the power 20, or 10 to the power 18 positions reachable under the rules of the game. And that's actually interesting, because they say, Hans Moravec says that the human brain can do 10 to the power 19 calculations per second. So the human brain, if it could devote all of its processing power to checkers, could reach all decisions in 1 second. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but anyways. Now, there's a myth that checkers is a solved game, but it's not, at least not entirely. Some of the end games have been solved, but it's going to be some time yet before checkers is solved. Now, then you've got chess. Now, for those who've played chess, you'll know that any given position, you can have as many as 30 to 40 possible moves. Of course, the vast majority of those are silly moves. But some, you can actually be in some situations where you have as many as 218 possible moves. Now, you can imagine that the subsequent game tree possibilities explodes huge after that. And the number of legal positions in chess is thought to be between, 10 to the power 43 and 10 to the power 50. It's got an estimated game tree complexity of 10 to the power of 123. Yes, just imagine that. One with 123 zeros behind it. Just to put that into perspective, there are more possibilities in chess than there are atoms in the universe. Actually, to say that that's putting it in perspective is a bit of a sad joke. To our Paleolithic human brains, that might as well be an infinite number. We can't even begin to fathom what a vastly huge number that is. So if even a computer like Fritz, which can calculate millions of moves each second, still has a rather profound game tree horizon with which to deal with. It still cannot chart an algorithmic course to guaranteed victory. That being said, modern chess computers are powerful enough such that they will not allow themselves to be put into dangerous situations. Fritz, he has a pretty formidable game tree horizon to contend with. It's way off, but it's way, way, way off in the distance as far as the humans are concerned. And I think this is a very, very demoralizing prospect from the perspective of human competitors. And adding insult to injury, chess is a partially solved game. Many of the end games are solved, and of course, also the chess bots have access to the opening books, which typically can be as many as the first 12 moves. And human players, they typically know that through memorization, and the grandmasters, they know it like the back of their hand. But so not only does the computer have the processing power to its capability, but it has centuries and centuries of opening game strategy to access. Well, what does this mean for the future of human and machine competitions? Well, I think that essentially it means that the day where there are meaningful matches between humans and computers are pretty much behind us. There's a part of me that believes that now chess will be only interesting in a professional sense, in a scientific sense, in a meaningful sense, by computer and computer matchups. But there's another part of me that still thinks that humanity might actually still play a role in chess. And just kind of backtrack a sec. Fritz was making moves during the tournament that left other grandmasters scratching their heads, wondering how and why it did what it did. And in many respects, the internal machinations of the computer is beyond human comprehension. Now, Garry Kasparov, he envisioned what he called advanced chess. Advanced chess is where humans, they use computers against another human who uses a computer. So think of it as your teammate is Fritz against another computer who has, let's say, Deep Junior or something. And the idea is that it's the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. That you would actually have this unbelievable team to work with chess. But I'm thinking that's maybe an obsolete idea, because the best human minds cannot understand what the computer is doing. And I think a human collaborator might only undermine the work of the machine. I imagine as the commentators were watching Fritz move, they were kind of even chuckling, like, why would it be doing this? So you can imagine that a grandmaster would probably more often than not overrule, overrule the decision of the computer. But more to the point, the computer might actually be playing better than the Grandmaster. Anyways, here are some ideas. If you're going to still have human computer matchups, there needs to be a bit of reform, and you got to make it a bit fairer for the computer, because we're not talking about a level playing field, and not all things are equal. You're talking about two different entities that go about chess very different ways. So, for example, let's take fairer time controls. I've got chess here on my Xbox, and when you play the computer, you're on a time control, and you're taking your time deciding what you need to do. The computer is just using seconds. Like, it's demoralizing. You're down to from 20 minutes, you're down to like 2 minutes left, and the computer has only used about 4 seconds. Like, that is ridiculous. And I think the same thing, I mean, the human mind doesn't work like that. It doesn't have that kind of a clock speed. It can't process that quickly. So one thing we could do is give it a better clock ratio. Anatoly Karpov has suggested a ratio of 2.5 to 1.4. I'd be inclined to give the machine even less time. Also, let's take away the opening book from the computers. It should be able to figure that out on its own. Let's take it away. And let's give humans access to the entire chess database. Other ideas you could have, and this one I like, is have a collaborative human team that consists of multiple grandmasters. So put, let's say, 5 or 6 of the best grandmasters together and their team against Deep Fritz. The trick, of course, would be to get them all to agree on a strategy in the next move, but I think what you'd need is like a captain who would consult with his team. That would be, you know what, I would very much like to see that. Another thing you could do is give timeouts for the human player, give them a bit of a break. And here's something that's maybe a bit embarrassing, but the ability to maybe take back one move per game. So, of course, there has to be an allowance as well, how many moves have elapsed since the take-back move. But, again, you could just kind of work that out. But the trouble is, the developers of the chess bots, they don't want to handicap their machines. These are very much promotional things. These are marketing ventures. And when IBM, the whole IBM Deep Blue thing was very much, in many respects, a contrived marketing event. And it was no coincidence that IBM's stock skyrocketed after its Deep Blue's victory over Kasparov back in 97. But, you know, the developers are going to eat themselves up if they don't make some changes, because there's only going to be a matter of time before the grandmasters don't want to be humiliated anymore by these number-crunching behemoths. And I think that the advent of handicaps would bring forth another excellent opportunity for some pretty entertaining tournaments and some high-quality chess. But, like I said before, as far as the advancement of chess is concerned, perhaps it's time for humans to take a back seat to the computers. I think chess has moved beyond us now, and we're no longer playing in the most meaningful and sophisticated matches in the history of the game. But that doesn't mean, of course, that you and I can't still enjoy the game. I play chess on a regular basis. In fact, I have 10 games going right now on GameNod, and I play with family members, and I've taught my kids how to play chess, because you know what? It's a lot of fun, and just because a computer can defeat us consistently doesn't mean that we still don't find enjoyment in it. So there's still a lot of chess, I think, that needs to be played.
What's it like out there? It's impersonal. It is the machine, if you like to put it that way, that has created you.
There is only darkness everywhere, darkness and water.
There's no light without darkness.
In the beginning, there was only the great self reflected in the form of a person.
Matter and spirit.
Reflecting, it found nothing but itself.
Body and mind and soul is what unifies.
This am I.
soul knows that I'm capable of evil.
Well, I'm running out of time now. I'm pretty much pushing the boundaries of 30 minutes, which is where I want to keep it at. So I'm going to actually, I'm not going to talk about my my brain tapping into the future article just quite yet. I'll do that next time. But before I go, I just wanted to mention that some political news here in Canada that's somewhat interesting, or maybe not. The Liberal Party, which is not in power right now, there's a minority conservative government in power. Part of the reason for this was the Liberal Party leadership was in shambles, but looks like they've got things sorted out. Again, that's debatable. But the new leader of the Liberal Party is a fellow by the name of Stéphane Dion from Quebec, a former university professor, and he defeated a couple of frontrunners, namely Michael Ignatieff and Bob Rae. And what's interesting, not just that he was a long shot, but speculation as to why he won the leadership was because he's a fairly green leader. In fact, he was the minister to the environment during the previous Liberal administration. And it would appear that Canada is turning green. And the Green Party is getting some, leaders are being now, you know, called upon for their green policies. But even the Green Party in Canada now is starting to show some legs. In fact, there was an election a couple of weeks ago in London, Ontario, and the Green Party had its best ever election showing. It claimed 25% of the vote. And that's in a significant area. They didn't win the riding. They got second place, but it was a real eye-opener. And this is good news because the current conservative government is embarrassing itself and embarrassing Canada, and we're embarrassing ourselves with the amount of greenhouse gases that we put out there. And things have got to change, I think, here in Canada, and looks like we might start to be on the right track. And perhaps Canada will very soon have the same kind of green politics that they have in Europe, where the Green parties have been quite successful for quite some time now. Of course, the traditional parties will seek to capitalize on these trends. I hope they don't just give lip service to environmental issues for political gain and that they actually do something. So we'll just have to see what will be in store for both the Liberal Party and the Greens in the future. Okay, that wraps up my podcast for today. Thank you for joining me. And like I said, I'm going to try to make this a regular thing now. Feedback is always welcome. And you visit my blog, Sentient Developments, and you're always welcome to drop me an email at george@betterhumans.com. And until next time, have a very pleasant evening. Bye-bye.